I'm Lance Carter, and you're listening to the Daily Actor Interview Podcast. Ricky Gervais is back as a host of the Golden Globes this Sunday. When he was asked why NBC brought him back, he said, "I assume they're desperate." He talked to a group of us on a conference call about the Golden Globes, The Office, his stand-up comedy, and more. I usually edit the interviews, so they aren't too long, but this one was special. He was candid and I think truly inspiring when he talked about his career. Hey guys, this site takes a lot of work, so I really appreciate it when you support our advertisers. And now, here's Ricky Gervais.
I feel like I'm some sort of robot. This isn't... Could I just say to all the journalists of America, I was on time. The reason we started late was because some journalists were late, and I said, no, let's start on time for the people who are kind enough and polite enough and punctual enough to be here. I mean, the Golden Globes are going to run like clockwork, I'll tell you. We're going to start at 5 o'clock, whether people are ready or not, okay? So, in fact, I've bought all the Hollywood foreign press a watch this year, so... so they can't be late.
I love how a lot of the Americans didn't get the reference during your last hosting gig to extras when you made the comment to Kate Winslet about the Holocaust. I'm hoping you're going to have some more stuff like that coming up.
Do you mean references that no one understands? I've got loads of those.
Yeah, that'll insult like a bunch of people.
Without them knowing it. An episode of Extras where Kate Winslet played the twisted version of herself, of course, and she was only doing a Holocaust movie to win an Oscar, and it came true, which was I honestly couldn't believe my luck when that happened. I don't think. A funny thing happened actually it was the Globes before that, Tom Hanks was telling me that he was on his way to work and he was listening to the radio and he must have just tuned in and they were playing a clip from the Extras that Kate Winslet was in, and she was saying, yeah, I mean, you know, do we need another Holocaust movie? I mean, and he thought it was an interview. He didn't realise he hadn't seen the show. So he thought Kate Winslet was on the radio saying she'd only done a Holocaust film to win an Oscar. And she thought, he went around telling everyone how, what is she thinking? What is she thinking? And then his producer said, Tom, that must have been a clip from the show. And he went, all right. Okay, and he spent the whole day going around telling people that Kate Winslet lost her mind. It's great, isn't it? Will I be? I don't think I was too bad. I don't think I went far enough. I think people know me now, and they know. You know, I think comedy comes from a good or a bad place, and I think however cheeky or out there or. You know, taboo subjects and dark places, I take them. I think they know it comes from a good place with me. The last thing I want to do is genuinely offend anyone. I couldn't live with myself, so I want the victims of the joke to like it as well. You know, I don't see any victory in going out and being awful and shocking. That's too easy. I mean, it's 5 o'clock. On network TV. You don't have to, I mean, people couldn't believe I went out with a beer. So if that's still shocking in this day and age, there is no victory in just being shocking. I think you've got to be interesting and engaging and, you know, and I try and do it with a twinkle in my eye and a smile on my face. Hopefully I can go even further this year and still not be chased out of the country.
As much as I love Extras, I feel that you really did it justice in the way that it ended. So I'd like to see, since you are the creator of The Office, what are the chances we could get Darren Lamb to lose his job at Carphone Warehouse, become the boss, and Carl Pilkington can come in as assistant to the regional manager?
They are, the chances of both of those in either order are slim to none. I don't think, well, Carl certainly wouldn't take it. I mean, it takes all my efforts for Carl to do anything. Carl is looking forward to being old so he doesn't have to do anything. He actually said that. He's looking forward to being old because old people are left alone. I went, what do you mean? He said, if you're old, you can sit in the street in an armchair and no one gives you a dirty look for being lazy. So that's his ambition, to be old so he doesn't have to do anything anymore. So he certainly won't take it. No, Steve wouldn't do it, and nor would I. The thing is, me and Steve get paid for doing nothing. So why would we work for it? You know, we've made so much money off Steve Carell. He's like a big goose that laid golden eggs for us. Now we need some other schmuck to come along and get up at 6 o'clock every day for 7 years.
Well, you can't blame the fangirl for thinking, you know, for hoping.
How did you feel that things went last year hosting the Globes? Were there things you learned from that you'll apply this year?
Yeah.
Quick follow-up.
Yeah, that's why I'm doing it again. I had such a great time, but like anything you do for the first time, you go, oh, let me do it again. I can do it better. Do you know what I mean? It's like the first time I had a go at golf. I wanted to go around again because I said, no, I can do it now. So, I want to give it one more go. I think it went well. I really enjoyed myself. I think I pitched it about right. But as I said, I think I can go a little bit further. I don't know. I just think I can really go out and really throw away the shackles of worry. I mean, I don't mean I'm going to go out and, again, get drunk and you know, have absolutely no planning or input. I think I can certainly have more fun with it, and I think I can have more fun with the room as well. I also sort of gave myself this weird restriction that I wrote it like a few days before in about an hour, all the lines, right? And if you notice that all the lines are about the people that are about to come out, and I've realised I can reference anyone in the room. I can look down and just go, right, I can go for anyone here. So I probably made it a little bit harder for myself than I could have, so I'm going to have even more fun with it, probably go a bit further, push the boundaries a little bit more. I think you always should. And what's the worst that can happen? I didn't expect to be invited back a second time, and I won't do it a third. So I've got nothing to lose. So I'm gonna go for it.
This is sort of a season of sequels for you, because in addition to doing the Golden Globes the second time, you also have a second stand-up special airing this month. And I'm wondering, how did you approach that with a specific aim as well?
Well, I don't know. I suppose yours. I've carried the same sensibilities with me sort of all my life, but you evolve. I suppose I deal with trying to say something challenging and interesting. I think a comedian's job isn't just to make people laugh; it's to make them think. I'm not a lover of broad anodyne comedy. You know, I don't see just going out there and saying things the audience could think themselves and often have. There's a place for that, but I also feel a responsibility. You know, I'm playing venues where people come out in their tens of thousands, and they've travelled a long way, and they've got a babysitter, and they've found a car parking space and paid $70 or whatever, and I think that I'd better have something special to say. So I always try and be different. As I say, I always try to be quite challenging. I mean, I want people to laugh. I want them to gasp as well. I get as big a buzz from a gasp as I do a belly laugh. But I think I do stuff that I'm proud of as well. And there's 6 billion people in the world. So if you do something for you that's, you know, a nice single vision and not like anything else, there's enough people that go, that was great, I hadn't seen that before, that's, you know, yeah. I think I want to be people's favourite comedian as opposed to in a mob. I wanted The Office to be people's favourite sitcom, as opposed to, you know, watched by loads of people in their 10th favourite. So you always feel that, you know, I think that's true of all art, that originality is the most important thing. And I think that makes, that will find a connection. The point of art is to make a connection with someone else, another human being that you may never meet or whatever. But I think the size of that connection with the individual is important. And I think you do that by being true to yourself. And if you're true to yourself, you are different to everyone else. And I think it won't be homogenized and watered down and, you know, like 10 other acts. I suppose I did have a revelation this time round that I did think this is a privilege. I mean, with stand-up, it was the fourth or fifth thing I did. You know what I mean? And my list of things that I consider myself, a stand-up was probably fourth, you know? And now I think it's great. I love the fact that it's, you know, outside the novel or something, it's the last bastion of self-censorship. You know, what a privilege to be able to say anything you want to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. That's how I approached it. And now I can't wait for my next stand-up, because I go, no, I know I went wrong there. I can be even better this time. And I think you should. It's like, you know, every day I become conscious for the first time. I know how to improve. I know what excites me now. Every day is a new day, and you want to improve. It's like, you know, you can rub out the blackboard and start again. I mean, those things can exist, right? But you can say, right, today I'm going to do my best work ever from now on. And I say that every day. It's also the sequel to the animation as well, which starts on the 14th of January. So yeah, second Globe, second special, and second. And I think I'm best second time around. I genuinely think that. I do. And I think me and Stephen write things that are better on their second viewing. And we write them with that in mind. And we were very conscious of that with The Office. We were putting in jokes that we thought people wouldn't even see first time round. But we said, you know what? Someone will see them the fifth time they watch it. And and what a compliment that people have listened to the podcasts five times or watched The Office five times. Or, you know, so... Yeah, it should be a good year. The year of the sequel.
Ricky, a little bit more about drawing the guests. We see a little bit. We see it in this upcoming HBO special, and we see it when you're doing the Golden Globes. Some comedians don't like it to tell a joke where the audience is either hush or mixed reaction or a little bit. You could tell they didn't like the joke. But when you tell one that just gets a little bit of a gasp, we see like a smile on your face or something. Do you genuinely enjoy it? Do you anticipate when you do one that the audience is going to have a mixed reaction to? Do you realize you're going to do that ahead of time?
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Because I think comedy and drama are different branches of the same tree. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're watching a horror film or hearing a joke. It's the surprise that's the good bit. Yeah. It's the bit you didn't expect. As I said, I don't consider myself just a comedian. People watch things I do and they go, that wasn't very funny. I want to go, no, it wasn't meant to be. It wasn't meant to be. You know, you say what you want. Some of my favourite things, they're not belly laughs. They're just watching with a warm feeling. You know, the Office wasn't just a comedy. It wasn't knockabout comedy. We purposely took out some jokes. We took out some big events. We took out some, you know, great plot lines because it interfered with the reality, or it interfered with the romance, or it interfered with the existential mood of the piece. You know, you've got to take the whole package, and something you put in takes away something else. Something you take away makes something stronger. And so it's my choices that count as a writer and a director. No one else's. So it's all or nothing. People can't cherry pick. They're not allowed to cherry pick. Not in art. You know, you can do that with a menu, but you can't do it in art. You take it all. And if people say, oh, I wish you'd done this, I say, well, you make it yourself. You do your own show. You do your own show, and you can have it exactly as you want it. Because that's how my shows turn out. Exactly as I want them. And when I'm live, of course I know that gasps come in. And, but it's there for a reason. It makes a point. And comedy is a release. Let's not forget that. Comedy is a release. That's why we do it. Because it's, obviously it's a, it's the industry built out of humour. And the reason we have humour is to get through. You know, the reason we have humour in our evolution is to get us through adversity. It's no coincidence that some of the most oppressed people have the best sense of humour and create the best comedy. I say in the special we use it as a sword and a shield and as a medicine and all these reasons. And I love taking people on an emotional journey. And that doesn't matter if it's a film, a TV show, or a piece of stand-up. It's to take people on a journey they hadn't been on before. And that's important. I want it to resonate as well. You go and see a stand-up and he does 1,000 brilliant puns. Great. You will laugh for an hour. You'll be looking at your watch after about half an hour, and you won't remember one of them. But if someone comes out there and he tells you a story, someone shambles out on stage and tells you a story, then there's nothing to compete with that. Whatever happens with innovation in entertainment, you know, there's going to be something that makes Avatar look like Steamboat Willie one day. But I tell you, it will never, whatever that is, it will never compete with one human being telling another human being what an awful day they've had. It won't.
Well, I just, you mentioned earlier in the call that you wouldn't do it, the hosting for a third time, and I just wanted to ask you why that was.
Well, the truth is, I'm not a host. I'm not a presenter. I don't think I should be doing it at all. I do these things for fun. I don't even count these things as part of my career, really. There's loads of things I do I don't count as part of my career, you know? I think the things that that I think are more timeless and that I've created from the beginning, I'd have had to invented the concept of award ceremonies to be as excited about them as I am about, you know, doing The Office or Extras or, you know, whatever. I suppose I want this to be great and go out on a high. I think you've always got to think that you're going to do a good job and it's going to be fun because you're in control. And if you're in control and it turns out exactly as you wanted it to, then you've got no one else to please, really. And I always try and... I want to do things that, you know, I'm pleased with. And so if I'm bad, I shouldn't do it again. And if I'm good, I shouldn't do it again. So I suppose that's the thinking, really.
You don't think you'll have such a good time hosting that you might be tempted, or NBC might be really tempting you?
Well, no, but then, you know, I was tempted to do a third season of The Office.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully I'm going to leave it just right. But again, that's my plan. Yeah.
That's great. And then, you know, speaking of The Office, the American version has a lot of changes coming up this season as Steve Carell exits the show. And I was hoping maybe you could comment a little bit about what viewers might expect as the season wraps up.
I won't give anything away about the show, but I think viewers can expect, you know, that if The Office carries on, it could be as good. And there's a lot of talk about who's going to replace Steve Carell. You should never think like that. You shouldn't think who's replacing Steve Carell. Steve Carell's an actor. You should think who's replacing Michael Scott. You know, you've got to get, you know, suspend your disbelief. It's meant to be a fake documentary. And it's all about the story. Even though we talk about what's going on behind the scenes, and we know Steve Carell's an actor, and he's not really working in a in a paper merchant in Scranton. It's what's good for the show that counts. And so the replacement should be a credible replacement within the story, within the piece of work. Not, is he going to be as big a star? Or, you know, because when we did The Office, we were all unknowns, which was perfect for the show. It wouldn't have worked if we were famous people. And, of course, now we're famous, as are all the people in The American Office. But I think you've got to do the show the service. It mustn't be about the politics and the business and, you know, what people write about it. It's got to stand alone one day. You've got to discover this in 1,000 years in a cave and put it on a player and enjoy it for what it is. Not know anything about what was happening behind the scenes or on the day. And I just think there's too much of this peeking behind the curtain, mm-hmm. and everyone worrying about what everyone gets paid or where they're going to... You know, I just you know, you should love it for the work. And that should be a surprise. So I'm not saying anything.
The line is of something so horrendous that you would never work again. You have to, you know...
Oh,
voicemail on you, Prince. Answer
you have these dark thoughts, and you go, "Well, why did that come into my brain?" But you know, as I said before, there is a constant fight in my head with what will go down well and what won't. But you know, as I said, you know, it comes from a good or a bad place, and if people know where you're coming from and what the target really is, you can get away with murder. Cue O.J. Simpson joke. But as I say, I don't use it as a platform to, you know, get political or get my own back on the world. I'm hosting a party. You know, it's a televised industry party. So you've got to keep it light. But as I say, that's not to say you can go out there and just do awfully fat, flat, broad, anodyne, homogenized, reworked material. I think you can be original and push the boundaries a little bit. And still come in line with taste and decency. That's my plan. But you can't win because, you know, everyone has got their own little cause. Everyone has got what they find offensive. You know, in my stand-up specials, you get letters saying, I love the show, although I was a little bit disappointed with the reference to, I don't know, the Holocaust. You know, I know a lot of people are, duh, 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 this is not funny. I want to go, but you like the jokes about children with cancer, you like the jokes about AIDS, African famine, disability. So you knew I was joking then, but when it comes down to your thing, because it's so personal, you can't see that, you can't treat it with the same distance, the same level of irony. You know, you can't realise that that's also... You know, satirical, but you can't win. So, you, in your heart of hearts, you've got to know you meant it in good faith, and you have to be able to justify it. I have a simple rule: if I can't justify why a joke's okay, I don't do it. I don't go out there. I'm not one of these comedians that go that comedy is your conscience taking a day off. My conscience never takes a day off. I can justify everything I do, and I can stand up and I can argue the point. On a right to reply show, I could actually say why this joke was okay to do, and I'll never lose that because I don't want to go home and go, oh, I shouldn't have said that. That's really awful. Why would I say that? You know, everything's considered.
One of the shows that you know, getting a lot of awards, the latest to sort of take the Office style, Modern Family. What do you think of shows that have sort of adopted that style of mockumentary that have that succeeded?
Well, I mean, any show that you know that people say was influenced by work is honestly flattering. On the other side, is that, you know, I didn't invent that genre. I stood on the shoulders of giants. The Office wasn't the first fake documentary. It wasn't the first sitcom without a laughter track. It wasn't the first sitcom to cast unknowns. It wasn't the first sitcom to, have flawed characters. It wasn't the first sitcom to look at the minutiae of life. But it was the first to probably have all of them in one sitcom. You know, a big influence, the fake documentary, is Spinal Tap, there. You know, a fake documentary where everyone's hilarious but acting very naturalistically. Larry Sanders, a wonderful ensemble cast of people, of flawed characters, and a sitcom nonetheless, a family, really, a family unit, just disguised with a backdrop of media, and nice and, deconstructive as well. These, all the aspects that we put into The Office had been touched on before. And in a weird way, we sort of stole from America and then sold it back to you. Because British sitcoms didn't really have anything other than a central character that bumbled around and was a fool and ended back at square one. Whereas Americans, had characters, they had little, nearly soap opera elements to their sitcoms, from the 50s and 60s through to the ultimate one of Friends, which was nearly a romantic sitcom, with jokes. So I don't know if we invented anything, but I suppose the realism, I don't think anything had been such a slave to the realism as us, and we probably cheated less than real documentaries. But we wanted it to resonate. And also we had the luxury of knowing we were going to stop. So we put everything into it. It's very dense, our version of The Office. It's meaty. It's made of lead. There's a lot in it. But you can't keep that. We couldn't have done 100 episodes with the intensity of, because we wrote it, we did it all ourselves as well. It's nice that we're even getting the credit for creating a recognisable style or genre. Someone said today that we reinvented the sitcom, which I'm very happy with that rumour going around. Yes, but again, it's a double-edged sword because I remember when The Office came out, one journalist said, "This is as good as Chekhov." And I thought, oh no, well now we're in real trouble. And sure enough, the next year, with a special went on television, one journalist said, "This is sub-Dickens." Like, suddenly, we're not as good as Dickens. No, we're not. There's a surprise. This sitcom isn't as good as the greatest storyteller of the last 300 years. It's like, you can't win. So, you have to take the rough with the smooth. For every 5-star review anything I've ever done has got, it got a 1-star review too, and everything in between. For everyone who thinks the sitcom is the greatest, most important sitcom of all time, there's someone who thinks it's the worst sitcom they've ever seen, and they want to gouge their eyes out rather than watch it. For everyone who thinks that I'm a funny man, some people want to run me over in a tractor. So, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Like I say, I'll take the laugh or the gasp, both as good to me, because I caused a reaction. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Now that Steve Carell is leaving, and as you look back on the American version, what are your thoughts about working with Steven, working in the American version of The Office, and working on American television?
I came to LA for the first time in 2004 to the Golden Globes, and there we'd done our little version of this English sitcom, which we were so proud of. We couldn't have been prouder of it because, personally, I'd never tried my hardest at anything in my life as writing The Office. And it's like I had a revelation at 39, 40 that this this is the greatest feeling in the world, to do something you've tried your hardest at and it turned out exactly as you wanted it, innit? And I sound like some sort of strange born again artist, right? But it, you know, that's the way I felt. I couldn't believe it. And then we went over and we thought we were making up the numbers, you know. And you've got to remember that America is my mecca in terms of entertainment. Everything I've ever loved on TV and film has come out of America, from Lauren Hardy and the Marx Brothers, through Woody Allen, who I think brought modern comedy to the movie screen. Great works of art in film and in TV. And in the last 10, 15 years, TV took on film and beat it on many levels. There was nothing as audacious in TV as The Wire and The Sopranos. And it even beat it as an art form, because with the pressure of movies to make their money back in the first 3 hours of opening, you know, they don't give it time to evolve, and it's these focus groups and begging people just to come out and just like it enough to do it again. Whereas things like The Wire, if The Wire had been based on ratings, it had been cancelled, you know. And it's amazing, and they kept that up. It's like an art factory, those things, like Sopranos and The Wire, and so TV had that to give us. It had to give us. There was no pressure. It was much more about the you know, the work of art itself, as opposed to the industry. And so to come to America and then win the Golden Globes and then to be asked to do a remake was ridiculous. I didn't even think about it at the time, because I thought, well, nothing's going to come of this. That's me being British. That's how we think. Nothing will come of this. And then we cast Steve Carell, who, by the way, I must say, joking aside, I always joke about him, I always tease him. I hope people know that I think he is one of the nicest people I've ever met, genuinely. There's no one like him. He's untouched by Hollywood, he's untouched by his fame, his cachet. He's just a lovely family man who loves comedy and the work, and he's done an amazing job above and beyond the Call of Duty. We never knew the remake was going to be this successful. I mean, it's the first successful British remake of a sitcom for 30 odd years, Sanford and Son or All in the Family or something, and they made it happen. That team made it happen. So I honestly, I don't think anyone has, but I haven't got a bad word to say about Steve Carell. And it's a great ensemble cast. They've kept the level up for you know, 100-odd episodes. It's a success story, commercially and in terms of an art form. And it's different to the English one. It had to be. You know, it's not so steeped in that the realism. You know, it's slightly broader. It hasn't got that existential quality. It's sort of lighter. You know, people are better at their jobs and more fun and all that. But that's true. That's the difference between English and Americans, really. It had to be that way. It really shows the difference between our two nations, I think, that the English and the American office. Americans are told they can be the next president of the United States. British people are told it won't happen to you. And it did happen to me. It's strange that I've come full circle. It started with the Office and the Golden Globes, and it's great. So looking back, it's been ridiculous. It's been like a dream. I'm going to wake up, and I'm 36, still working in my old job. I'm still working in the office where I got the idea from, and I'm going to wake up and go, I just had the best 12-year dream I've ever had.
Hi, everybody. Unfortunately, we have to end here.
Oh, no, I'm talking about myself. It's brilliant.
Well, you could go on, but you have a schedule to keep for the rest of the day.
Everyone's pretending to be really interested in me.
You actually have 27 more questions, but we have to wrap it up. And
one more. Choose one more. Choose the best one. This is the best question. This is the best of the 27. It's like an award.
Okay.
So everyone knows who they put in there. So this is the winner of the best question of the final 27.
Thank you. There's no pressure in this question at all.
This is better than Bucky Gunts.
I know. Well, with that in mind, I'm going to try to make this the most epic-sounding question ever.
Go on.
Looking back at the history of your career, everything you've done, from the British Office to the new animated series to extras, can you even pinpoint just one moment where you would say, this is the defining moment, I can't believe I'm doing this?
Boo! This is like Avatar winning. Boo!
You should know. Have won.
defining moment. It's difficult. I mean, I'd have to say meeting Stephen Merchant. If this was a biopic, it would be. You know when they do that, and it's like, hey son, what's your name? My name's Clay Cassius, sir. You know what I mean? They go, my name's Andrew Dundee, and I think you've got a great left. It would have to be meeting Stephen Merchant. But then how far back do you go, you know? I worked in an office. It would have to be people watching. I grew up in a funny family, you know? I grew up in a family where humor was the most important thing. If you paid your way, then, you know, having a laugh. If it's career, well, it's clearly making The Office. If it's, I don't know, I don't know what else to base it on. The honest answer is there's whatever specific question it was related to, there'd be a different specific answer. I mean, I think the I think if you take for granted, you know, you are a product of your entire upbringing, from being born to friends to education and through, I think obviously a defining moment was meeting and working Steve. The Office was the breakthrough. Career highs would be things like winning the Golden Globes in 2004. That was a strange week. Because let me tell you, this is what happened, okay? So as I said before, we went over there. I didn't even think that it should go. I thought it was a long way to go and lose. That was my, you know, and people said, you're mad, it's an experience, you know. So, yeah, it'd be great. So we won the Globes. I did my first acting job that I hadn't written for myself on Alias, because J.J. Abrahams was a fan. I haven't watched it. I've never watched the episode. It was me being cool. I can't watch that. I dread it. It sends a chill down my spine, me trying to be cool. But I hear it's okay. And then I was called for an audience with Matt Groening and Al Jean and The Simpsons lot. Their favourite show was The Office, which is weird because they created the best show, you know, ever. And they said, do you want to write one and be in one? Yeah. And that was the same week we started working on The American Office. That was one week in January 2004. So if you had to pinpoint a week, it would be January, the last week of January 2004. But, you know, everything's joined to something else. Everything's inextricably mixed. There's no defining moment, really. It's just, you know, luck, keeping a cool head. I think it happening to me relatively late in life was important. You know, all these things, knowing why you're doing it every day, knowing that you're lucky and privileged, but then really working hard at it. And you know, my dad was a labourer all his life. He used to get up at 5:30 every morning, 5 or 6 days a week till he was 70, and he never complained. I live a strange, rarefied life. The least I can do is try my hardest and take it seriously. I think sometimes I come across as smug and pompous and, you know, just taking comedy too seriously, but it's the only way I can do it to get through. I know it doesn't matter. I know none of this matters. We're all going to be dead soon. But there are some people that hate their job, and they hate everything they do, and they do it because they've got to feed a kid. And the least I can do is try my hardest at something, and know that I'm going to be proud of everything I do, and have a legacy. I felt guilty the first time when I did The Office. It was, as I say, a revelation. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't have been prouder of it. Okay, and then it was a success, and I was still just proud of The Office, but I was glad it was a success. And then the first check started coming in, and it was silly money, and it ruined it a little bit, because I thought, oh, I didn't do it for that. And people don't understand that. They don't understand that. I did a corporate gig in the early days, because it was the for doing 40 minutes was the same as my dad's wages for a year. And I did it because I felt guilty. I thought it was irresponsible not to. Then I thought, no, it's not. Just do things you're proud of. Just do things you can stand by. You're not here to collect money or awards. You're here to just fill your time with stuff that you like before you die. That's why I do it. See, your question was really good, actually, but I brought the whole tone down. I think people have turned off. They think I was going to make some jokes.
Back in 2004, when The Office won, that was such a victory. Not necessarily because it was an award or a trophy, but because of the fact that it was art and it was something different. And there were so many people here that were just like, I'd never even heard of this show when it won. And then they went and kind of discovered it, and it turned their mind onto something new.
Well, that's really nice. And it's so funny you say art now, and I bandy the word around, but for the first 2 or 3 years of being famous, I was scared of using the word art because I thought it was pretentious, and I didn't want to put myself. I never thought it was for me to say I was an artist. I thought that was like some sort of honour that's bestowed on me. But now I think it's my responsibility to consider myself an artist, because that's why I'm doing it, and it's being honest. I can't apologise for that. So that's really nice and flattering, and I really haven't changed my views other than my work ethic, that doing it is the reward. Doing it itself is the reward. I wish there was more of it. I just wish there was more of it. Just people going, I don't care what happens. I don't care about the box office. I don't care about the ratings. I don't care about the reviews or the awards. I did this, and it's the best thing I've ever done. And I think if we had that, it would just be amazing. It would be incredible, but it can't happen. Because by definition, most things are rubbish. And that's true of any genre, not just art. Art, TV, furniture making, most tables are rubbish. But when you see a really brilliant table that the guy spent 4 years making, and he was a master craftsman, and it's lasted 700 years, you want to cry. It brings a lump to your throat. I want to bring a lump to your throat. So that quote taken out of context looks really bad.
Thanks, Ricky, and thank you guys for listening. Keep coming back to Daily Actor for more great interviews, columns, and resources. I'm Lance, and I'll talk to you soon.